Good morning, Colorado. You're listening to The Daily Sunup. The Daily Sunup podcast is a conversation with the Colorado Sun. See our trust indicators at coloradosun.com/ethics. It's Friday, May 31st. Today, it's once again time for a look at Colorado's literary scene. This week, Sun writer and Sun Lit editor Kevin Simpson chats with an author whose book, re-released after more than 20 years, examines a tragic but often overlooked moment in Colorado history. Before we continue, the Colorado Sun is partnering with multiple news outlets across the state to understand what is driving Coloradans this election year. What issues do you care about most as we head into the 2024 election? Let us know by filling out our survey at coloradosun.com/votervoices. Now, let's go back in time with some Colorado history. In late May 1935, after weeks of rain, Colorado faced devastating floods. Elbert County endured the worst, with Kiowa Creek rising dramatically on May 30th. An intense storm dropped 8 inches of rain, causing the creek's depth to surge by more than 8 feet. By nightfall, Elbert County realized the extent of the disaster. The flood obliterated half of Elbert and severely damaged Kiowa. The Colorado National Guard and Civilian Conservation Corps were brought in to aid recovery efforts with the incredible damage. 20 people lost their lives while floodwaters reached as far as Nebraska and Kansas, and the Colorado and Southern Railway line in Elbert County had to be abandoned. Before we continue, join the Colorado Sun on June 25th as Equity reporter Tatiana Flowers speaks with a panel about how they see mental illness falling through the cracks, what some solutions are or ways to address the issues, and more. The event is free and virtual. RSVP today at coloradosun.com/events. Next, our feature story.
Welcome to another Colorado Friday, listeners. You know, two of my favorite things are lesser-known chapters of Colorado history and literature, and today we get to talk about both. Our guest is Ariana Harner, who formerly worked for the Colorado Historical Society, which you now know as History Colorado, and who collaborated with colleague Clark Seacrest, who some of you might also remember from the Denver Post. They combined on a fascinating book. It's called Children of the Storm, The True Story of the Pleasant Hill School Bus Tragedy. Welcome, Ariana.
Thanks, Kevin.
So, first of all, tell our listeners a little bit about what happened on that day back in March of 1931, way out on the Eastern Plains near the Kansas border that became the foundation for your book.
Sure. So, it was the very end of March, as many of us who've lived in Colorado know, can be winter, it can be spring, it can be one, it can be both of those things in the same day. It happened to be a really warm day in the morning, like unseasonably so. So a lot of the kids who were getting on their school bus didn't wear the warmest clothes because they thought it's spring today. I can just get by in a sweater. And the way the school bus worked was that a guy, a community member who had a farm truck, put on top of that farm truck bed, kind of a cover that made it into a school bus. It was wooden. It was 1931, so pretty rudimentary. And he'd go around picking up each child and their siblings from their homes in a fairly small contained area and take them to the one room schoolhouse. This Pleasant Hill school bus school district actually had two separate schoolhouses, but they were right next to each other with the same schoolyard. So they got on the bus, got to the schoolyard, and as they were getting close to the school, it started to snow, which nobody had expected. And there was a conversation among the bus driver and the two school teachers about what to do. And ultimately, the decision was made that the students would be safest if the weather happened to turn bad, if they were to go to one of the nearest farm families' homes where there'd be fuel and food and blankets if it got cold, all of those things. They piled on the bus and the driver set off toward one of those houses. Unfortunately, what happened was that the bus wasn't able to make it to the house. It got stuck in a ditch, and there was the snow had really intensified to a whiteout condition, and the students ended up being there all day Thursday and all day Friday. By Friday afternoon, they were rescued and taken to a nearby farmhouse to try and warm up and get some food. But some of the kids actually froze to death on that school bus. It was a horrible, traumatic experience for them. And that's just the first half of the book. The second half really goes into what the Denver Post primarily did with the story and how it inserted itself into the story as kind of a savior of these children. So it was actually a lot that happened.
Now, originally, your book was published more than 20 years ago, and now it's being re-released after all these years. What's it been like for you to revisit your work after all this time?
You know, I went on and had a life completely unrelated to this and kind of forgot about it. So I've reread it a couple times now so that I can speak intelligently about it. What strikes me is that the story is just as interesting and relevant now as it was in the early 2000s. The heart of the story is the same. It's not a new edition. It's a re-release. And when readers in a few months see that, they'll see that the present tense is used with the survivors, for instance, as it was in 2001 when it came out. But that's okay. It's the same story.
So I want to mention here that we've got a terrific excerpt from the book, which will be available on coloradosun.com starting Sunday, along with an author Q&A. So be sure to check that out. But, you know, one thing I found particularly compelling about the story is how it was told and in some cases sort of co-opted to serve specific agendas. I mean, this was a national story, wasn't it? How was it told?
Yeah,
in some cases, kind of manipulated.
It did get national press. Typical journalistic integrity calls for reporting the facts and not creating things and calling them facts. But what was happening in the 1930s with the Denver Post, the publisher at the time, Fred Bonfies, was very interested in embellishing and blowing things up. And he did that with this story, which is probably part of why it did get such attention. One of the children, in fact, was invited to visit President Hoover in the White House. President Hoover wasn't very popular. He wasn't doing that well. It was the beginning of the Great Depression, and he wasn't meeting the desires or the needs of the general population during this really intense time for them. So his PR people said, well, this will humanize you a little bit. Have this little farm kid from the eastern plains of Colorado come see you and get pictures with him. And that became a big part of the story that we told, because it wasn't, at no point was the desire of that particular student really considered. It was all about what other people wanted from the story.
And, you know, one of the things that's become prominent these days, especially where history is concerned, is the question of who gets to tell the story. We've seen it play out in any number of different ways. But in this case, you and Clark felt that the perspective of those kids you talk about who were on that bus didn't really get the attention they deserve. So how did you go about trying to set the record straight here?
It's pretty simple. We asked them for their side of the story, and we wrote that. I think whatever the Denver Post was trying to do, get a scoop or sell papers or cheer up readers or make themselves look like heroes, they embellished and they fabricated and they threw a week-long party for the children. The big irony that I see is that the story was a fully fleshed out human interest story as it was. It didn't need any of that. The Post could have written the facts and treated them like humans instead of objects, and the Post still would have sold papers.
So what was it like for you and Clark? I mean, interviewing the adults now who had lived through this traumatic experience as kids, years later even, what kind of reactions did you get? What kind of memories did they have? Or were they still vivid memories for these guys?
Great question, Kevin. Every single survivor was so sweet and welcoming. Clark talked to a couple in the early 90s, and then I spoke with the rest in person in the late 90s. I traveled to their homes in Oklahoma and Southern Colorado and Nebraska, other places, and they were all so happy. Happy is an oversimplified word, but they were very willing to talk about their experiences. In fact, now that I'm older and I have a more well-developed sense of personal privacy for myself, I'm really amazed at how willing they were to discuss their experiences. Most of them had talked about it over the years to some extent with friends or family, or in some cases with local newspapers. But there were some for whom the emotion was just right on the surface. They still felt it felt very, very real for them. And I have a lot of empathy for that. I really felt for them carrying that around for decades after the fact.
As the person sort of charged with telling their story, you really felt invested in helping them sort of get this side of the story out. I mean, what kind of reaction did you get after the publication of the book initially?
I think each of the survivors, I remember them each writing me a letter saying, thank you for this. We were really pleased. I don't even think I saved those at this point, but it really meant a lot at the time because we were so motivated by wanting to do right by the story and right by the individuals, which doesn't mean everybody was pleased with every detail because different people remembered the same things slightly differently. One person said she thought we were pretty hard on the Denver Post, for instance, but in general, it was really positive.
So tell us a little bit about the research element here. You obviously spoke to the survivors, but you and Clark, given your background with the Historical Society, and I know, Clark is a reporter at the Post for years, really dove into documents and newspaper accounts. How complete a record was there, or are there still aspects that might never be known about this case?
There are definitely aspects that might never be known. For instance, while there was a lot of information in the newspapers at the time, we knew some of that was untrue. Our best primary sources were the survivors. We also got a lot of really helpful information from family members of survivors who had since passed on, but they'd either told their family their perspective on certain things that they remembered, or they'd even written things down in some cases. What I really wish is that something from the school teacher, Maud Mosier, that we'd been able to find something in writing from her. I mean, that's every historian's wish, right? Is to just suddenly this information magically appears. Maud Mosier was, whether it's fair or not, she was blamed for sending the children off into the school bus, into the storm, and she was essentially run out of town, and we'll never know her side of the story. So yes, the book would have been richer if there had been any primary sources directly from her. We did work hard to resolve discrepancies where we could and where we couldn't to make note of that. I think it's important for the reader to know that different people remember the same details differently and that we weren't pretending to believe one over the other arbitrarily. We're just passing along what they said and then sharing whether or not we were able to pin it down. Sometimes you have to go into the end notes to find that information, but it is there.
Well, finally, I wanted to ask you about how the tragedy is remembered down in that part of the state. Is it still to this day talked about and acknowledged, or has it been memorialized in any way?
Definitely. The local school administrators are still pretty quick to cancel school on really snowy days. And in fact, for the reprint, we wrote an introduction, a new introduction. Clark talked with the current school superintendent in Holly, who explained that the new consolidated school building was built to be incredibly sturdy in severe weather events, big enough to shelter the whole town if necessary. And I'm guessing that not every small town in Colorado has prioritized their limited budgets in the same way.
Well, once again, the name of the book is Children of the Storm, The True Story of the Pleasant Hill School Bus Tragedy. And it's available at fine bookstores everywhere. And remember to check out the excerpt and the Q&A with co-author Ariana Harder starting this Sunday at coloradosun.com. Thanks for joining us, Ariana.
Thanks for having me, Kevin.
And listeners, remember, if you enjoy the podcast, please leave a review on whatever platform you use to tune in. Thanks so much for joining us, and we'll do this again next week.
You can read more at coloradosun.com. Finally, here are a few stories that you should know about today. A new analysis shows that firearm injuries in Colorado caused at least $8.4 million in medical bills in 2022. The report from the Center for Improving Value in Healthcare is the first of its kind to examine some of the economic impacts of firearm injuries. It reflects a growing effort in Colorado to think of gun-related injuries as a public health issue. To conduct its analysis, the group relied on the state's all-payer claims database, which has anonymous data from more than a billion Colorado medical claims drawn from more than 5.5 million people. About 1,500 head of cattle, led by dozens of wranglers on horseback, commuted alongside traffic on Colorado 149 on the western slope this week before reaching open pastures south of Blue Mesa Reservoir, where they will spend the summer grazing. The shared journey put a different spin on the cow's annual trip from public land to a private ranch west of Gunnison. Vehicle traffic and the cattle shared 3 miles of the highway, which has been part of the detour to get from Montrose to Gunnison since the sudden shutdown of the Blue Mesa Bridge last month. A lightning strike that killed a cattle rancher in northern Colorado this month was the 25th lightning death in Colorado since 2006. That's more fatal lightning strikes than all but two other states, Florida, which had 88 during that time period, and Texas with 39. The death of Colorado rancher Mike Morgan was the first lightning fatality in Colorado since 2020, when a woman was struck while walking her dog in Durango. The National Weather Service said it was also the first known lightning fatality in the nation in 2024. By this time in the spring, the U.S. averages 3 lightning deaths. For more information on all of these stories, visit our website, coloradosun.com. And don't forget to tune in again next time. Now, a quick message from our team.
This is Michael Booth.
And this is John Ingold. We cover health and climate here at the Colorado Sun.
Every week, John and I work together to send out a newsletter to our premium members called The Temperature.
In this newsletter, we share our latest reporting about health and climate and how they intersect. Issues like forever chemicals, healthcare's rising costs, and the lingering effects of the pandemic. The Temperature is one of our weekly newsletters available to members at the premium level.
To sign up, head to coloradosun.com/join. Not only will you be able to sign up for The Temperature and our other premium newsletters, but you'll be supporting the Colorado Sun as a member, and thanks for doing that.